You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Webb Smith, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure.
You're our second time guest. The other one is Jesse, who is my co-founder. So I feel like that barely counts. So that's pretty cool.
I'm honored. This is a big deal to me. I love what you guys do. I talk about you guys all the time. Jesse's a hero to me, obviously to a lot of people, as are you. And So this is really, really special for me.
And I just found out it's your birthday. So happy birthday. I'm doing my best here getting you on the show. I don't know if that's not exactly the gift I would have made if I knew that it was your birthday, but it's great. Great to have you on.
Thank you. It's my 35th today. And I feel like I'm looking more and more like James Earl Jones every day. So that's
I've never made that comparison before, but now I see it. You just have to develop the deep voice.
I'm working on that. I'll try it.
So if people don't know, you are the founder of 2PM. People might know 2PM Links, your great email newsletter about the e-commerce world, which has now developed into a little bit of an empire. You've made it a paid subscription that has like access to a few new resources. You've hired someone. Tell me a little bit about what's going on with 2PM these days.
Sure. You know, I have high hopes for my former hobby. I guess it's no longer a hobby. We are doing some pretty special things. We are constantly trying to build out the tools and refine them and add to them. We're maintaining consistency from a curation standpoint and from an editorial standpoint. Megan's been on board for about 3 months, someone I trust dearly. Her and her husband are dear friends of mine and my wife. And we have parallel careers. And we just thought, hey, this could be a really good fit. And it's turned out to be so. She's very, very smart and she's very organized, which is helpful for me, because I'm doing a lot at once and she's really good about telling me what I'm doing wrong and what I could be doing better. She is the director of marketing for an agency called Prestige Pro Media, and they handle several things that they do. They also handle Logan Paul's paid traffic and conversion. So that, I mean, although Logan Paul isn't the most cherished figure right now in the YouTube space, from a purely e-commerce standpoint, he's an eight-figure player. Annually. I mean, it's not a small, he's doing everything right when it comes to how a creator is supposed to execute e-commerce. Anyways, I digress. 2PM is going really well with our help. We will be launching our first original content within the next 3 weeks. We're releasing a book by chapters over the next 12 weeks, starting July 6th. And she is co-writing it with me.
Wow.
So,
well, if anyone listens to this, 2PM makes a lot of sense for you to go read. It's just a great newsletter, and now it's a resource. So we've actually sourced a few questions from your readers. And we're going to jump into that, just like last time, kind of doing a little bit of a roundup. This week, we had WWDC, and Safari has been updated with a big thing, which is trying to curb a little bit of Google and Facebook's reach online with some new privacy features. What are you seeing there, Webb?
That's a really good question. Nothing in the super short term, but the pendulum is swinging. Before you know it, in my opinion, the efficacy of those Facebook ads, of Facebook's reach, of Google DFP and their ad server, it's going to drop off a little bit. And vertical brands and marketplaces are going to have to find a new way to reach top funnel customers. We are being proactive on our end. We are working with individual vertical brands. Can't really name them yet, but we are working with Common Thread Collective to establish a new form of top funnel advertising to sort of offset what Facebook and Google does for these brands. And I'm really excited to get that up and running. I could talk about that if you'd like, but it's exciting to me, might not be exciting to everyone else.
Well, I do think, you know, speaking of online brands in general, I think Facebook in particular has been a huge channel for growth. This thing that Apple's introducing is trying to make it harder for people, for these tracking services, to get a good picture of what you're up to online. But it still seems like, you know, there's not that much control over what you're going to do on mobile or what you're going to see on mobile. So I wonder if how it's all going to come together. Plus, a lot of these companies already have that data about you and probably can still sort of track you. So it's, I'm very curious about how effective that will really be. But it does seem like the pendulum is swinging in that direction.
I mean, yeah, you have to consider a few things. There's what's going on with the GDPR in Europe.
Right.
Right now, if you're advertising, let's say you want to reach all female consumers between the age of 25 and 34, your reach has dropped tremendously in the past few weeks because Google's essentially not operating that ad server in Europe right now until they have the bugs fixed. So you're seeing it from that perspective, obviously, with the new OS and what Safari is capable of doing. A lot of people are going to opt out of it. It's going to be sort of a mirror of what happened with advertising a few years ago, where you were allowed to begin blocking ads within your browser. Same thing. You're going to see an influx of that tracking being blocked on the consumer side. And that's going to affect the way that you spend on ads and the way that you expect your return. And so one of the things that we're doing to stymie that is we're developing a new sort of traditional advertising mechanism based on some data that is, you know, pretty useful, but will be served in real life through co-branded mailers. And I can explain that later, but we think it's going to be a really, really great experiment. And we have two brands on board with a tremendous reach. And we think that they're going to do something that will begin to trickle down to other brands that want to reach new customers.
So, you know, outside of advertising, you have content marketing, you have a lot of brands who are experimenting with retail stores. What's the gamut of other possibilities if like that starts to shrink? Or, you know, the other option is just it's getting way too expensive for a lot of companies to do it that way.
Yes. So I'll give you our example. Obviously, you're going to see more and more retailers, more online retailers going the pop-up route and the physical retail route. You're going to see a lot of traditional advertising, more spend in magazines, maybe billboards, you know, especially the digital variety. But what we're working on is imagine, you know, you take a segment of brand A and you advertise brand B to that segment through in-package mailers. So this is sort of right up your alley. We have two brands. One brand ships 50,000 packages a month. The other brand ships about 15 to 20,000. And the bigger brand is allowing the smaller brand to insert, let's say, 15,000 mailers in their outgoing packages with call to action to interact with the brand online within 24 hours of receiving that package. So we are formulating what we think the CTA is going to be, you know, and what the potential conversion is going to be once that's up and running. And I think that's going to be really exciting for both of those brands.
Yeah. Anecdotally, what I've heard from a variety of sources is that direct mail is making a comeback, which is kind of a crazy idea. But I have been seeing them in my mailbox, you know, these DNVB note card type of format things coming into my real physical inbox with, you know, photos of mattresses and things that I can buy on the internet.
Yeah. So imagine taking that one step farther and, you know, you have another brand's promo within a brand's package that you trust.
Right.
So you are an e-commerce shopper. You like a brand that's adjacent but not competitive to the brand that will be featured in that package. We think that that is a formula for success. So if 15, 20,000 packages go out, you know, we expect action on anywhere between, you know, 500 and 2,000 of them.
I'll be very curious to see how that works out. It would be really interesting to see in a few months. It sounds great. I mean, I think that, you know, we've been involved in a little bit of that with some of the companies that use Lumi and actually marketing their brand on the outside of the packaging or doing co-marketing on the outside of the packaging, which is interesting. We don't have a ton of data into how well that's working yet, but it's something. I'm trying to think of an analog in the non-digital world, but one of the other questions that came through from the 2PM listeners was, who do you think will be the biggest advertising company in 2025? And I actually did a little bit of research on this one just to kind of refresh my memory on what the numbers are right now. So if you look at the top 10, basically, like Google and Facebook are way ahead of everyone, with Google being around like 37% of all digital spend in the US, then Facebook at 20%. And then you have like Microsoft, Verizon / AOL, Amazon, all around 3%. And then you've got Snapchat and Twitter down at 1%. But the only ones who are actually going up right now are actually Amazon and Snapchat, which is kind of interesting.
Correct. If I had to be audacious, I would say Amazon's going to be the number one.
Wow. By 2025, you think?
By 2025. I think the safer bet's probably Google. I think that Facebook's going to suffer a lot more than Google will over the next few years when it comes to privacy issues. But I do expect Amazon to be number one or number two. They are growing so fast in the advertising department year over year.
Yeah.
And again, as Amazon continues to monetize their search, which they're not really doing quite yet, it's going to be a real boon for growth. Right now, if you're searching for something online, 60% plus of those searches are on Amazon.com, and they have yet to really monetize that. So time will tell, but that's not too audacious of a decision.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you that Facebook is going to be hurt a lot more than Google. On the other hand, I think that Facebook might be able to stem a little bit of that through Instagram. That's been like the biggest area of growth for them. Amazon, I think the sort of dark horse, like what's going on there is, what are they going to do about monetizing Alexa? Because that's a huge area where there's already some rumblings of like, you know, paid placement on Alexa. Have you seen anything there?
I haven't. But just to add on to what you were just saying, here's the difference between Amazon's data and, let's say, Instagram / Facebook's data. Obviously, Facebook is using cookies to track you across the web, whereas Amazon is focusing on what you're purchasing. They're building a profile on you based upon what you actually convert on. I think that moving forward over the next 3 to 5 years, that information is going to be far more valuable than what you're searching or what you're looking at across the internet. And so as the traditional data that we're experiencing now, or that we're giving up to companies now, begins to be cracked down upon, it's Amazon's data that will have the premium and that will be less invasive and acceptable, less invasive and more acceptable moving forward. And Instagram doesn't have a cart. Facebook doesn't have a cart. They don't control commerce at all. I think that's the advantage. And I think that's what you're going to see playing out moving forward. But obviously, Alexa is a huge opportunity for Amazon. It's a black box. I'd be a fool to make an assumption based upon what I think Alexa is going to do quite yet when it comes to advertising.
I think the idea that people have been prognosticating out there is that you will say to Alexa, hey, you know, I want some toilet paper, and it will go and look at your previous purchases and say, do you want this or do you want brand B, which will be 50 cents cheaper, and like insert that ad at that point in time, which, you know, I don't know how people will feel about that experience, but it seems like it could be effective.
It could be effective. Also, you know, once Amazon moves further into podcasting and tying in Audible to commerce operations, there's going to be a lot of opportunity where you're hearing about a product in a podcast through your Alexa or through your Echo, excuse me, and you're, you know, you have the option to buy that product in line with the actual podcast. Things like that no other platform can really do, because again, few platforms, if any, actually control conversion. They don't control commerce. So I'm really anxious to see how Amazon ties in audio with actual commerce from that perspective.
Amazon also has ads on the Kindle. You know, there's that like cheaper Kindle you can get that has ads on the front of it. Do you think that they would ever not require a Prime subscription to be able to have access to their TV shows or the music and do something like what Spotify does and monetize that through ads?
I really don't. I mean, Prime is just so valuable to Amazon as a tool to offset costs and as a tool to sort of determine whether a consumer is valued in their by their own metrics. Everything that they do is driven to add to the Prime roles. So I don't see them essentially making like a lighter version of their existing content for non-Prime subscribers. I think they're going to go even harder into it, especially as they justified the price more and more.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. It's just there's so much with everything that Amazon's doing. There's so much placement opportunity in every different vertical that they're in. I'll be curious to see where they decide to put their efforts when it comes to advertising. Snapchat, what do you think? They've been through a lot of rough times. Where do you think they'll be in 2025?
Oof, man. I don't count them out. I never do. Whenever I think about counting Snapchat out, they do something really smart on the commerce front. So I'm anxious to see what the next year is going to look like. And I might be wrong. I heard about a recent development that will allow them to integrate more e-commerce into their day-to-day actions. I think it's a ticketing service, whether it's SeatGeek or something. I think that's the kind of stuff that with Snapchat being able, you know, being able to use that service and then swipe up or whatever to buy the ticket that you're seeing in line in your advertising. That's the stuff that's really, really valuable that Instagram hasn't really been able to execute quite yet. And if they can hold on to their existing audience while giving them the tools to actually convert on what they want to do, then yeah. I think they'll stick around. I don't think they're going to become the business that we thought they were going to, but they'll stick around.
Is there a company that doesn't exist yet that you think could make it on that list by 2025? It seems kind of hard.
Ooh, I don't. I mean, all of those companies are platforms, and those platforms are all decades old at this point.
Yeah.
With the exception Snapchat, but Snapchat, they've still put in their time. I would be very surprised if someone comes up and bites them. I just don't see it.
Yeah, especially trying to get to the number one spot in the next 7 years, that would be pretty incredible if that could happen. So we'll see. We'll have you back in 2025 and see where we're at on our predictions. Okay, here's another question, somewhat related, that came in. What overall trends are you seeing in content versus commerce, or content plus commerce?
Wow. So I think that the number one thing that I'm seeing, there are a few ways to look at content and commerce. In my opinion, no one's really doing it better than the New York Times. I think you're starting to hear it on a few of their podcasts. You know, how do you support this podcast? You support this podcast by subscribing to the New York Times. Every outward impression, every piece of content that they're making is being faithfully digested by the public because they do such a great job at it. And it's all funneling back to subscriptions. And I think that is a huge win for the New York Times. I don't think that anyone is doing it as well as they are. From a more traditional standpoint, meaning digital publishers that are selling physical products, I'm still anxious to see what the Goops do. I know that they've just moved into physical retail, sponsored physical retail, meaning they have a large brand paying for each physical retail location that they're going to have. That could be something that's cool, but I still think that New York Times is the tentpole that we should be looking at, and they have every facet down, whether it's direct to consumer commerce, affiliate marketing through their Wirecutter acquisition, or through paid subscriptions. They're doing a really good job of all three.
this is somewhat related, but you also got a question in about Patreon and their acquisition of Kit recently. They're going more in that direction of affiliate. Maybe it's worth mentioning what Patreon is. Do you want to walk people through that?
Sure. So Patreon is a way to subscribe to the creators that you are consuming, that you love. So it's essentially a membership to their content, to their offering. You are a patron of their arts. And Patreon's done a wonderful job making themselves synonymous to that action, much like Kickstarter's made themselves synonymous with crowdfunding. So to grow the ability for those 150,000, 200,000 creators to make more money, naturally, they have to find more ways to authentically appeal to those creators' audiences. And that next move is affiliate marketing. And probably right after that's direct-to-consumer commerce. And so they've acquired Kit, who's done a good job of packaging affiliate sales in a new and inventive way. And apparently Kit is also moving to be able to handle the merchandising logistics that Patreon will need to allow those creators to sell their own merch. Now, that's easier said than done, but it's really exciting to see that Patreon cares enough about their creators to move in that direction. It's a win if Kit can execute. That's a big if.
Yeah, Patreon has done a really good job overall of staying agnostic of where the creators are, you know, whether that's YouTube or podcast or a blog or, you know, it can really be anything. And that's, I think, good to have that neutral party. I would start to get concerned if they start developing too many of their own, like, first party solutions to that. If, like, the place to go for your music or your video or your content is Patreon. And I wonder if this sort of nudges them a little bit in that direction of not having that objectivity. What do you think about that?
That's a really good question. I think where you're creating the content and where you're cashing in on that content that you're creating, I think that's two different things. I don't think that Patreon's ever going to say, let's build a YouTube competitor, or let's build a competitor to Audible or our own podcast network. I don't see them doing that. But they do need to develop the tools for their creators to make money. So this is a natural progression. I think that they have a lot of opportunity to forge relationships with the right partners to actually achieve those objectives. I'm not a real big fan of Kit being the acquisition, but, you know, again, objectively, you know, I can see, you know, why they went that direction for an affiliate marketing, for I guess a move towards affiliate marketing operations.
Yeah, I think that the idea of the digital tip jar that you can, you know, pay your favorite content creators has been around for 20 years. Like, people have been theorizing about that for a really long time. And now there's some newfangled ideas around blockchains and how that could change that whole idea. But Patreon's probably the most successful company I've ever seen attempt to solve that problem. And they've come at it from that very creator-centric perspective. And I think they've done a good job. It'll be really interesting to see if this affiliate approach ends up working well. It's not a business model that I personally know very well. It seemed like it was very successful early on as a method. People would, you know, do Amazon affiliates and that kind of stuff. But over time, just the value of that wasn't worth the effort. It seemed like people who relied on that as a method of generating income for their blog, let's say, the value of that seems to have gone down quite a bit. So is that something that can change in the future?
That's a really good question. To be successful at generating revenue for your affiliate business, you have to have a pretty sizable audience. So if you're Marques Brownlee or Casey Neistat or whomever in that category, then sure, yeah, you can probably drive 1,000 conversions a week, you know, 4,000, 5,000 conversions a month. That's going to net you $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 per month. But unless you have an audience that big, affiliate marketing is really not the way to go, which is why merchandising, traditional merchandising, shirts, hats, pins, things of the such, would be a much smarter move because the margins are higher for you. Instead of making $5 on that product that's, that costs $100, you're making $15 on the product that costs $30.
My first interaction ever with Kit was actually through Marques Brownlee, who, for people who don't know, has a channel on YouTube called MKBHD, which is just an incredible YouTube gadget and tech channel that has millions of subscribers. That's how I discovered Kit for the first time, through his page. But when you think about him as a person, what is he able to authentically sort of pitch as products? It's, you know, maybe tech products and mostly camera gear. And those are all things right. that cost thousands of dollars, and where the conversion rate is going to be probably extremely, extremely small for someone who's just sort of a drive-by, oh, I wonder what Marques likes. So I saw you tweeting about this the other day, and I can't find the tweet, but you were saying something to the effect of, it's really fascinating to see who is able to get their audience to convert. It's like, it's really an interesting thing. I mean, maybe it's moving people from one medium to another, or it's just having a lot of reach or a lot of followers doesn't necessarily equate to having a very engaged audience. What have you learned about that, I don't know, in the past couple of years?
So that's like the question of the hour. You know, we've talked about this previously. I'm trying to figure it out. Some of it is the lack of interest by their communities, but another part of it really is that I don't think that a lot of creators really want to sell things. Mm. If you think about it, a lot of folks that are in that position, they're trying to grow a tangible number, a subscription, like a subscriber base, rather. Like you're growing an audience. You're actively trying to become a celebrity. You're actively trying to become cooler than you were the day before, you know, by all metrics of media. And can you be cool and sell things at the same time, in your opinion? Can you hawk things, or can you promote things without losing your effortless appeal to be cool? I'm growing to think that the answer for most people that are still scaling that mountain, that answer is no.
Well, I think the similar thing applies to every brand as well. You know, when you're if you're a company and your email newsletter comes out twice a day and it's just, you know, promotions for your products, you know, the conversion rate is going to go down pretty quickly. And I think maybe that's the fear among creators, or it's the fear among brands that value themselves as being a more premium offering. Finding that balance is, it seems like, one of the most tricky things in marketing.
Sure. So that's the thing. Like, that's what I've been racking my head over, trying to figure out the solution for. And one of the ways that brands, the vertical brands that you know and love, that I know and love, they don't rely solely on that type of push promotion, that type of email, tweet, Facebooking promotion. They rely on inbound, right? They pay for paid traffic. They retarget previous visitors. So one thing I feel that we need to figure out with creators is, dear creator, how much are you willing to invest in your own passive promotion? So are you willing to say that, hey, here's a $10,000 budget over the next 2 weeks to buy the traffic so that I'm not having to push it myself, or that I'm balancing paid traffic with organic traffic? Because that's where the money's made. I mean, that's what the Logan Pauls are doing. That's what the Gary Vaynerchuks are doing on their own platforms. And I think that's really important to consider. That type of promotion doesn't tarnish their perceived celebrity like pushing tarnishes their perceived celebrity.
I'm guessing if you ask most of the creators, the tension is that they're trying to go through something like Patreon because they're artists or creators and they're trying to make the thing most of the time. And so operating more like a business is difficult because it takes time and knowledge to get good at doing that kind of retargeting, or, you know, getting better at developing that inbound interest. I wonder if there's a thing there for Cotton Bureau or for Patreon or for some platform to help automate a little bit of that stuff or make it less demanding on the creator.
The answer is yes.
and people are thinking about it.
Yes, I'm thinking about that on the hour. And I believe that I have a solution for that. But again, it's going to come down to, okay, creator, you'd rather not spend all day being a salesperson. Are you willing to invest in your own passive promotion? If the answer is yes, then we can do business.
I mean, I think maybe the best example of that to mention is 2PM itself, because you've gone from, you know, essentially a free product to now having this like paid subscription sometime in the last 6 months. I forget exactly when that happened, but what have you learned about it now, kind of doing it firsthand with your business?
So I'm in a tricky position. I'm not doing anything paid. Everything is organic. And everything is organic because I'm trying to achieve a certain number of paid subscribers organically. That's important to me because I know that if I'm achieving them organically, I'm earning a particular executive, like a particular type of person within the industry. They already know someone that's already subscribed. They know someone, they trust that person. I'm building a coalition of people that are at the top of their craft. Once I start advertising to reach those people, then I feel like I will begin to degrade the coalition that I'm building. I don't ever really talk about this, but if you saw the people that were on the list, sometimes it astonishes me. Like I know that like they wouldn't talk to me in person if they weren't a part of the list. Like there are some amazing executives and leaders within the space. And so you don't get those people by targeting them on LinkedIn or Facebook quite yet. No, if and when I'm trying to move from tier A to tier B, then that's a different conversation.
So is Twitter your way to get to them? How do people even find out about you?
So the way that I've focused on it thus far is I've established my free newsletter as the top of the funnel. So you know, everything that I do is focused on growing that top number, because I believe that if you experience that letter enough, eventually you'll see the value in paying for it. And so let's say that I'm trying to grow that number to X thousands, then I suspect that between 5 and 10% of the overall, like the aggregate number of free subscribers will become paid subscribers.
Makes sense.
And so that's my funnel. So it goes essentially from Twitter or parallel relationships with that person in the office to free subscription to eventually converting to a paid subscription. And it's happening organically so far. It's going to level off eventually. And then that's when I'll worry about determining, you know, the cost of acquisition for every customer.
Well, I'm a subscriber, but I feel like it's just an investment in making sure that I can get you as a guest on the podcast again.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
No, I'm just kidding. I read it. I read it every time it comes out. It's been really great. You had a great article about the recent shutdown of Radin. I don't know how to pronounce that. I think it's Radin.
Is it Raiden?
Raiden?
I thought it was Raiden, like the character from Mortal Kombat.
Well, either way, what was there to learn from that particular closure of that company? They were making direct-to-consumer suitcases.
Oh, wow. There's so much to learn. If you read any media quote that Raiden's founder ever gave, he was so anti-brand. He was so focused on, here is the tech of the luggage. The product speaks for itself. I don't need to do anything else. The brand will sell itself. The product will sell itself. Whereas Jen and Steph on the Away side, very early, if not before the product even launched, said, here's the lifestyle of the person that we want to use our luggage. So when you start with that palette, the sky's the limit. That canvas allows you to say, okay, not only are we going to focus on this particular piece of luggage, we're going to build a magazine around your lifestyle and these other adjacent products. And hey, we might even go into a travel jacket that we want you to use someday. Whereas Raiden was completely focused on that one, well, the variance of that one SKU. And I think that came back to bite him.
Well, we should mention, that a couple other startups in that space had to shut down, and there was a big change in regulation that happened earlier this year that caused all of the electric powered suitcases that have like a built-in battery to be no longer legal, and they have to have a replaceable battery. So that had some impact on that, I'm assuming.
It did. Let's be clear here. There isn't a brand in that space that didn't raise more, that raised less than $5 million. Okay. So one of the common refrains that I've heard on Twitter was, Away raised so much money, so-and-so only raised $5 million. $5 million is a lot of money. You know, that's a pretty sizable investment, even if you're building a product like that. I know this from experience. So it's not as much of a handicap as people like to think it is. On that note, about 50% of those companies had the technology to remove the battery. In Raiden's case, their second generation that was supposed to come out this year also wasn't going to have a removable battery. It was a situation where one founder was so focused on tech, that's all that matters, tech, that they were almost blinded by Porter's five forces and what was going on in the industry. Whereas Jin and Steph are focused on brand and then tech. Hey, it makes sense to have a removable battery or to develop a system with a removable battery. That's sort of the dichotomy that we're looking at.
Yeah.
Because again, Away is building two products at once, the brand itself and the tech. Whereas other companies were just focused on the tech. And I know that this is sensitive and I never root against anyone, but I think it's a valuable lesson that a lot of brands have had to learn.
Yeah, I'm totally in agreement that, you know, there's a lot of value to building a brand and to having your customers trust that overall mission, that broader idea. On the point of the, you know, $5 million they raised, just doing some like quick back of the envelope math, like assuming they put all of that into, you know, product as opposed to, you know, I'm sure they put a certain percentage of that into hiring and ads and that kind of stuff. But, you know, their product was probably around $200, $300 on average. If you just like back of the envelope it, it's probably $100 like bill of materials. So that means they could make in the range of 30 to 50,000 suitcases. And that's not including like the different styles, you know, sizes, colors, et cetera. It is, I think, for that type of company, pretty devastating when you have, you know, a year's worth of inventory that you have to invest in suddenly become obsolete. So I don't want to sweep that under the rug completely. And there must have been something about, you know, I don't know why that second generation wasn't designed with that in mind. It seems like maybe there was a way that they could have seen that coming around the bend. But even though those numbers, and, you know, from coming from a bootstrapped world, I've had that kind of pain myself where, you know, investing in inventory that becomes obsolete is like, it can be really, really hard on your cash flow, even if you have raised money. So I want to balance it out a little bit.
Sure. But again, the one thing that I'm saying is product alone is never enough. Winning on the merits of the product alone is never enough. And so one company was focused on destroying the other company based upon the merits of the product. By what I've heard, Raiden had a superior technical product.
Yeah.
That's what I've heard. But if you look at tennis shoes or any other category, it's not always the most well-done technical product that wins the race. That's just the reality of branding.
Yeah, we had a great episode a few weeks ago that was with the founder of Fuzzco, which is a design agency. She had some really great points on that. So if anyone wants to dive more into like the importance of brand, obviously they're a branding agency, so they have somewhat of a bias. But we're entering this world now where there's so many new brands launching every day that differentiating yourself purely as, you know, we have this business model of being a vertical commerce brand is not enough. You have to go beyond that. You have to tell a story. You have to like bring a whole cohort of customers with you And that's becoming harder and harder. I don't know. It's a big topic to open as we're wrapping up, but have you seen anything there that has, who's doing it right, I guess, is the question.
Well, I'm going to use this opportunity to talk about someone that I, again, my colleague at 2PM, Megan, her DNVB launches later tonight.
Wow.
She's developed leggings that will last a lifetime. And if by chance they don't, you can receive a new pair within 14 days. So she's done a wonderful job of developing the customer acquisition system with her team, but also emphasizing on brand differentiation and product differentiation. So it's like a three-pronged operation, and she's done a wonderful job of emphasizing all three equally, which I think is really, really important early on. And so, yeah, I think that once it launches, I think you're going to hear a lot about it. And I'm excited to see how she's using a lot of the lessons and how, you know, her team is using a lot of the lessons that other brands are teaching them and executing on them in fruitful ways.
Well, we'll make sure to get a link in there to that if the name's a secret. It will be probably launched by the time this comes out.
Yeah, it's not a secret. The leggings brand is called Mellow, and I think the URL is just wearmellow.com.
Cool. All right, we'll put that in the show notes. Webb. Hey, thank you so much for joining on your birthday of all days. Last time we talked to you, you had some major health situation. How the leg's going?
Oh, the right leg is still gimpy, but I'm getting there. You know, I think I look normal walking. luckily you can't see my gimp on this podcast, so I feel really confident right now.
Well, I'm so happy you could join us today, and we'll have you again in 2025 to review the top advertisers. Thanks again. And we'll put all those links in the show notes. If people want to find out more about you, read all your insightful tweets. You've got the best Twitter handle in the business at web, twitter.com/web. And then 2PM, get subscribed, 2PML.com. That's coming out. What's the rate these days of updates people can see?
So Monday and Friday. We're going to maintain consistency. You can count on us. We'll be there 2 p.m. on Monday, 2 p.m. on Friday.
Anything else I should plug?
Happy birthday to me. And I'm going to go have some fun with some whiskey.
All right. Enjoy.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review. Could be just a sentence long. By going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.